So this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got, a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. I highly recommend checking them out at certfuel.com. So usually when people talk about starting a business, there's this expectation of simplicity.
Right, like a lemonade stand.
Exactly, yeah. You build a wooden box, squeeze some lemons, hang a painted sign, and you just start selling. It's clean commerce. You have a product, someone gives you money, and you hand it over.
Right, the fundamental basis of a free market. It's very visible and straightforward.
But then you step into the world of the US securities industry, and suddenly hanging that painted sign without the right paperwork isn't just like a minor administrative mistake, it's a federal offense.
Yeah.
We are looking at a regulatory landscape that is an absolute labyrinth.
It really is. It is the definition of a high-stakes environment. I mean, regulators don't view a financial firm like a lemonade stand. They view it like a nuclear power plant. Yeah, because one wrong step doesn't just cost you money. It can vaporize your client's life savings, trigger systemic market risk, and basically end your career before it even begins.
Which is exactly why we're here. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Our mission today is to deeply master broker-dealer registration for the Series 24 exam. But, if you're like me and you have a brain that aggressively tunes out dry textbook lectures, I'm just going to memorize a bulleted list of government forms. To actually pass this principal exam, we have to learn the underlying mechanisms. We have to understand why the regulators built the rules this way.
Absolutely. That is the only way to survive the Series 24. Because the exam writers are incredibly skilled at testing the gray areas. They aren't going to ask for a dictionary definition. They're going to give you a highly complex real-world scenario and ask you to apply the rule.
Right. So to make this stick, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters today because abstract rules fade, but vivid high-stakes scenarios burn into your memory. So let's set the stage. First, we have Broker Bob. Bob is the ultimate middleman. He doesn't want to tie up his own capital. He just connects a buyer and a seller for a cut. Then we have Dealer Dan. Now, Dan is running a massive operation. He buys securities, parks them in his own corporate inventory, takes on all the market risk, and sells them directly to clients.
And that risk profile right there between Bob and Dan is the foundation of the entire Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
Okay, and we'll also be checking in with founder Fiona. She is our ambitious empire builder. She's constantly acquiring new firms, changing her business model, and kind of testing the limits of her compliance department. And finally, there's reckless Ricky. Ricky is the rogue trader who is always exactly one bad decision away from getting permanently barred from the industry. So we'll use them to map out the entire life cycle of a firm. But before we can even talk about registering a business, we have to figure out what kind of business we're actually running. Are we Bob or are we Dan?
Right. And that takes us all the way back to the aftermath of the 1929 stock market crash. When Congress wrote the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, they realized they had to separate the industry based on how a firm handled risk and client money. So this is the statutory definition of capacity.
Okay.
The Series 24 exam built almost every single registration question on this one foundational fact pattern. Is the firm acting as a broker or as a dealer?
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's break down the mechanics of Broker Bob first. If I'm acting as a broker, what is my legal capacity?
You're acting as an agent. The statutory definition of a broker is any person engaged in the business of effecting transactions in securities for the account of
For the
others.
account of others. Okay.
Exactly. Bob doesn't own the stock. He doesn't take on the risk of the stock dropping in value while he holds it. He is simply an agent matching a buyer and a seller in the open market. And because he takes on zero inventory risk, his compensation reflects that. He earns a commission.
So it's very much like a real estate agent. Like if I'm selling your house to a new family, I never actually buy the house myself.
Right.
I don't carry the mortgage. I just facilitate the handshake, ensure the paperwork is clean, and I take my 6% commission. I am Bob. I am an agent.
Precisely. Now contrast that with Dealer Dan. The statute defines a dealer as any person engaged in the business of buying and selling securities for his own account. Yeah, Dan acts as a principal. He isn't matching buyers and sellers. He's buying millions of dollars of securities into his own corporate inventory.
Which means if the market crashes overnight, Dan takes the hit.
Exactly. Dan is taking on massive market risk, and because of that risk, he doesn't charge commission. When he sells to a client out of his own inventory, he earns a markup. When he buys from a client into his inventory, he earns a markdown.
So, sticking with the real estate world, Dan isn't an agent. Dan is like a massive property flipping conglomerate. Mm-hmm. He buys a neighborhood of houses. He owns them. They sit on his balance sheet. And then he sells you a house he legally owns for a higher price than he paid for it.
That's right.
He's acting as a principal. But wait, in the real financial world, we don't really have broker firms and dealer firms. We call them broker dealers. Don't most firms do both?
They do. And that is where the exam will try to trap you. A single firm usually registers as a broker-dealer because they have the capability to wear both hats.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the critical legal mechanism. They can never wear both hats on the exact same trade. Capacity is determined on a trade-by-trade, tick-by-tick basis.
So on Monday morning, the firm might act as Broker Bob, going out to the New York Stock Exchange to find me 100 shares of Apple, charging me a commission. But on Tuesday afternoon, they might act as Dealer Dan and sell me 100 shares of Apple directly out of their own corporate vault, charging me a markup.
Yes. And you need to be hyper-vigilant when reading test questions. The agent versus principal split is one of the most heavily tested concepts. If the question says a firm buys for inventory and resells, it's Dealer Dan. If it says the firm matches buyer and seller, it's Broker Bob. And remember the ironclad rule of compensation. Compensation always follows capacity.
Got it. Broker equals agent equals commission. Dealer equals principal equals markup. I'm guessing the exam tries to mix those up.
Oh, all the time. They'll give you a scenario where a firm acted as a dealer selling from inventory, but the answer choice says they charged a commission.
Mm.
That is structurally and legally impossible. It is a regulatory violation. You cannot charge an agency commission on principal trade.
Okay, that makes sense. But I want to push back on the definition of a dealer for a second. The law says a dealer is someone buying and selling for their own account. What about retail investors? What about my neighbor who sits at his computer all day buying and selling options in his personal E-Trade account?
Right.
He is buying for his own account. Is he technically Dealer Dan? Does he need to register with the SEC?
No, your neighbor is protected by what we call the trader exception. The statute specifically targets people who are engaged in the business of effecting transactions. And individual day trading in their own account is buying for personal investment. They're a trader, not a dealer, because it's not a regular business operation providing liquidity to customers.
Okay, listener, I want you to pause and think about this next scenario. What if our day trading neighbor is incredibly good at what he does, and his sister asks him to manage her account too? He's just buying and selling stocks for his sister's account to help her out. What is his required action? Does the trader exception still protect him, or does he need to register? Let's think about the mechanics here. My initial thought is, it's just family, so maybe it's fine.
Yeah, think about that for a beat.
Yeah.
Because it is absolutely not fine. This is a massive compliance trap. The trader exception applies exclusively to dealing for your own account. The minute your neighbor starts affecting security transactions for someone else's account, even a sister, even a best friend, he steps out of the trader exception and directly into Broker Bob territory.
Because he is now affecting transactions for the account of others. He just met the statutory definition of a broker.
Exactly. He has crossed the regulatory Rubicon. Now, there's one more major exception to these definitions, and that is the bank exception.
Okay. Banks do a lot of financial transactions. Are they brokers?
Under the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, banks doing traditional banking activities like trust services, safekeeping, custody, or certain networking arrangements, are excluded from the broker-dealer definition. The underlying logic here is about avoiding redundant regulation. Banks are already heavily scrutinized by the Federal Reserve, the OCC, and the FDIC. The SEC doesn't need to regulate a bank's trust department as if it were a brokerage firm, provided the bank stays within very specific statutory lanes.
Makes total sense. So we know who Bob and Dan are. We know who gets an exception. Let's move to the actual process of opening up shop. Broker Bob wants to start his firm. What is the actual trigger that forces him to walk up to the government and register?
The trigger is the registration mandate under Section 15A of the Exchange Act. The law states that it's unlawful for any broker or dealer to use the mails or any instrumentality of interstate commerce to affect transactions and securities unless they're registered with the SEC.
Interstate commerce. That sounds like a massive threshold, you know, like you need to be running trains of physical stock certificates across state lines. But legally, how broad is that definition?
Oh, it is incredibly broad. If Bob sits in his office in New York and sends a single email to a prospective client in New Jersey, he has triggered interstate commerce. If he picks up the phone and makes one call across a state border, he's under federal jurisdiction.
Wow.
There is no small firm exception. There is no, I only have three clients exception. The moment you use modern communication networks, you belong to the SEC.
So Bob is on the hook. He needs to register. This introduces the most important piece of paperwork in a firm's life, which is Form BD. Let's talk about the mechanics of Form BD. It's essentially the firm's permanent identity badge. It tells the regulators who owns the firm, what kind of business model you're running, and importantly, the disciplinary history of the people in charge.
Right. And the genius of Form BD is how it integrates into a three-tier registration system. In the U.S., a broker-dealer has to answer to three different levels of authority. You have the federal tier, which is the SEC. You have the SRO tier, the self-regulatory organization, which is usually FINRA. And you have the state tier, which enforces local blue sky laws.
That sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare. I mean, if I'm Bob, do I have to print out three different massive stacks of paperwork? Do I mail one to Washington, D.C., one to FINRA headquarters, and then 50 separate packets to 50 different state capitals?
Well, you used to, decades ago.
Hmm.
But today, you file a single unified Form BD electronically on the CRD. That's the Central Registration Depository.
Okay.
The CRD is the master database for the entire securities industry. When you hit submit, that one system automatically routes your permanent ID badge to the SEC, to FINRA, and to whatever specific states you check off on the form.
Okay, wait. So let's say Bob files Form BD on the CRD. The SEC reviews it and grants him federal registration. He gets the stamp of approval from Washington. He's good to go, right? He can start executing trades for clients.
Absolutely not. And this is exactly where the Series 24 will try to trick you. Federal registration alone is essentially an empty vessel. The SEC is the ultimate authority, but they don't micromanage the day-to-day operations of every single broker in the country. They delegate that to the SROs.
So having SEC registration but no FINRA membership is like having a driver's license but no car?
It's more like having the title to a car, but the government hasn't given you license plates to drive it on public roads.
Ah, I like that.
Yeah, if you were only registered with the SEC, you cannot legally operate. You must be a member of a self-regulatory organization like FINRA to transact over-the-counter securities business or deal with the public.
Okay, so the SEC is the filing cabinet, but FINRA is the cop on the beat. You need both. Okay, so Bob gets his Form BD approved by the SEC and FINRA. But businesses evolve, right? Bob moves his headquarters. Or maybe he hires Reckless Ricky, and Ricky comes with some significant disciplinary baggage. Bob has to update that Form BD, right?
Yes, Form BD is a living document. The rule requires that amendments be filed promptly. Now, the word promptly in regulatory speak can be frustratingly vague, but for routine changes, like a change of address or updating an officer's title, it's generally understood as 30 days. If the information on the CRD becomes inaccurate, you have 30 days to fix it.
Okay.
If it's a statutory disqualification, it's even faster.
Now, listener, wake up for this one detail. This is highly testable. Think about books and records retention. How long does a firm have to keep its organizational records? Things like the original Form BD, the articles of incorporation, or the partnership agreements. Most records in this industry are 3 years or 6 years. But what about the foundational DNA of the firm?
Those must be kept for the life of the enterprise.
The life of the enterprise, forever. Why is the SEC so aggressive about that? Like, why do they care about a partnership agreement from 1985?
Because when massive systemic fraud occurs, think about cases like Enron or Lehman Brothers. Those had different structures. Regulators and bankruptcy courts need to pierce the corporate veil. They need to understand exactly who owned what, who had controlling interest at the moment of inception, and how the legal entity was structured. If a firm could just shred its original articles of incorporation after 6 years, regulators would lose the ability to trace the ultimate accountability.
That makes total sense. You can't investigate the collapse of a building if you don't have the original blueprints. Okay, so Form BD covers the entity itself. It's the umbrella. But Dealer Dan is running a massive operation. He wants to open a second location across town. Does he file another Form BD for the new building?
No, Form BD is strictly at the corporate entity level. For specific physical locations, you use Form BR, the branch office registration form. Every location where your firm conducts securities business must be registered. But this introduces a major operational challenge. Not all branch offices are treated equally by FINRA.
Right. We have standard branch offices, and then we have the heavy hitters. The OSJ, or Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction.
Correct. FINRA's supervisory rules mandate a strict hierarchy. A regular branch might just have a few brokers making cold calls and discussing mutual funds with clients, but an OSJ is a critical nexus of risk. It requires a registered principal on site, it requires much more frequent internal inspections, and it holds a higher level of liability.
So, listener, let's test this. Direct question for you. Think about the mechanics of risk. If broker Bob opens a tiny two-person office in a suburban strip mall, it's small. But in that office, a principal is sitting at a desk reviewing and approving new customer accounts. Is that location a standard branch, or does FINRA consider it an OSJ? Let's think about why approving an account matters.
If you guessed OSJ, you're correct. Approving a new account is not an administrative afterthought. It is the frontline defense against money laundering, identity theft, and suitability violations. Because that critical risk management function is happening at that location, FedFinder automatically upgrades it to an OSJ.
Wow. What are some of the other automatic OSJ triggers?
Final principal review of public communications, order execution, market making, or structuring public offerings, or, crucially, maintaining custody of customer funds or securities. If you hold the client's money, you are an OSJ.
So size does not matter at all. Dealer Dan could have a 500-person call center, but if they are just doing basic solicitation, it's a branch. He could have a one-person office in a broom closet, but if that one person is making markets and taking inventory risk, boom, it's an OSJ.
Exactly.
And Form BR must reflect that.
Right. Which brings us to the next phase of the firm's life cycle. The SEC accepted your Form BD. You've filed your Form BRs for your branches. The paperwork is filed. But FINRA does not just rubber stamp a business plan. They act as a regulatory gatekeeper.
This is the NMA process, the new member application.
Right. The SEC checks to see if your form is complete and legally sound. But FINRA's membership application program, known as MAP, checks to see if you can actually run a complex financial firm without bankrupting your clients. They evaluate the NMA against 14 specific standards of admission.
14 standards? What are they actually digging into? It sounds pretty invasive.
Oh, it is deeply invasive, by design. They want to know, do you have a fully documented supervisory system? Do you have the required financial resources, meaning strict net capital requirements? Are your books and record systems fully compliant with SEC rules? Do you have reasonable training programs for your staff? They evaluate your business plan, your clearing arrangements, and the specific background of every single person in management.
Now, here is where the exam will test your understanding of legal mechanics. In a criminal trial, you are innocent until proven guilty. The burden of proof is on the state. But in the NMA process, who holds the burden of proof?
The burden of proof is entirely on the applicant, the firm. FINRA doesn't have to prove that you can't run a compliant firm. You have to affirmatively prove that you can.
So if FINRA reviews Dealer Dan's application and says, you know, Dan, we aren't completely convinced your net capital projections are realistic given this volatile market, FINRA doesn't have to go out and hire economists to prove Dan's model is broken.
No, they don't. A tie goes to a denial. If FINRA is unsatisfied, the application is denied. It is entirely up to Dan to provide the evidence, the stress tests, and the financial models to prove he meets all 14 standards.
It's pure regulatory gatekeeping. You have to prove you belong in the industry. Okay, so founder Fiona goes through this grueling process. Her NMA is approved. She's officially a FINRA member firm. But Fiona isn't the type to just sit still. She wants to acquire other firms, shift her business model, and basically conquer the industry.
And when Fiona makes those massive structural changes, her original NMA isn't valid anymore. FINRA approved a specific business plan. If she changes the plan, she has to file a CMA, a continuing membership application.
And this is where the exam writers set a very specific, highly testable timing trap. There are two different tracks for a CMA, depending on exactly what Fiona is trying to do. Let's look at them side by side. Scenario A is an ownership change. Let's say Fiona decides to sell a massive chunk of her firm to a private equity group to raise capital. She is selling 25% or more of her equity. When does she need to file the CMA?
For a material change in ownership or control, which is defined as a merger, an acquisition, or transferring 25% or more of the firm's equity, Fiona must file the CMA at least 30 days before the transaction takes place.
30 days before. But let's think about the reality of corporate finance. M&A deals move incredibly fast. If she files 30 days before, does she have to sit around and wait 6 months for FINRA to formally approve the CMA before she can close the deal and get the cash?
No, and that is a crucial distinction. She must give FINRA 30 days advance notice. But once that 30-day clock expires, or the agreed-upon deal date hits, she can legally effect the change and close the deal, even if FINRA is still reviewing the paperwork. FINRA can impose interim restrictions if they see a glaring red flag, but generally, the deal can close.
Okay, but why does FINRA allow that? Why not make her wait?
Because capital markets rely on liquidity and speed. If FINRA froze every merger for 6 months while bureaucrats reviewed paperwork, it would destroy the value of the deals. They require the 30-day notice to take a quick look for systemic risk, but they allow the business to proceed while they do the deep dive.
Okay, now contrast that with scenario B, a material business change. Instead of selling equity, Fiona wants to radically change what her firm actually does. She originally registered as a mutual fund retailer. Yeah. Now she wants to start underwriting massive IPOs, or she wants to start making markets in volatile tech stocks. When does she file the CMA?
For a material change in business operations, the timing rules completely flip. She can file the CMA at any time. There's no mandatory 30-day advance notice.
Oh.
However, she absolutely cannot put the new business change into effect until FINRA concludes its entire review and formally grants approval.
So if it's an ownership change, file 30 days early, but you don't have to wait for the final blessing to close the deal. If it's a business change, file whenever you want, but you're completely frozen until FINRA explicitly says go.
Exactly. Think about the risk. If Fiona suddenly starts underwriting IPOs without FINRA checking if she has the proper net capital, she could bankrupt the firm in an afternoon and take clients down with her. The operational risk is immediate, so the approval must be explicit before she starts.
Listener, do not cross those two timing tracks on the exam. Ownership is 30 days before. Business change is wait for approval. Now, there is one more sneaky trap tucked into that 25% ownership rule.
Yes, the 25% threshold is a single person or single entity test. It is about identifying who actually controls the firm.
So what happens if Fiona raises capital by selling 5% of her firm to five completely different unrelated investors? That's 25% of the total equity changing hands. Does that trigger a CMA?
No, it does not. Because no single person or entity acquired 25% or more, there hasn't been a concentration of control. FINRA views that as routine capital raising. But if one massive private equity fund swoops in and buys 26% in a single transaction, that is a change of control. The CMA is triggered instantly.
That is fascinating. It's all about who is holding the steering wheel. Five people with 5% can't steer the firm. One person with 26% has massive influence.
Okay, let's look at another expansion scenario for Fiona. Let's say she doesn't just sell equity. She uses her capital to buy an entire existing broker-dealer outright. She's taken over their operations. This brings us to successor registration. When one firm succeeds another through a buyout or a merger, the regulators have a massive logistical problem. They don't want a regulatory gap. They don't want the old firm's registration to die on a Friday and the new firm's registration to be stuck in SEC processing until next month. If a firm operates unregistered for even a week, customer accounts are legally in limbo and SIPC protection could be compromised.
So how do they bridge that gap?
Through the successor rules.
Yeah.
Let's say Fiona buys the firm. The old firm, the predecessor, files paperwork to withdraw. Fiona, acting as the successor, has 30 days to file her brand new Form BD to take over. To ensure there is no gap in customer protection, the SEC allows the old firm's registration to carry over and protect the new firm for up to 45 days.
30 days and 45 days. Listener, the exam loves to test your memory of those two specific numbers, and it is very easy to swap them in your head under pressure.
A good way to remember it is that you have a shorter window to do your regulatory homework, 30 days to get the Form BD filed. But the SEC gives you a longer window of legal grace, 45 days of carryover protection, so that processing delays don't kill the business. 30 days to file, 45 days to survive.
Okay, what if Fiona's ambition extends beyond the U.S. borders? What if a foreign broker-dealer based in London wants to start trading with U.S. customers?
The overarching foundational rule is that if you touch a U.S. customer, you must register with the SEC, period. The SEC's mandate is to protect U.S. investors, regardless of where the phone call originated. However, there is a very specific foreign broker-dealer exemption under Rule 15A6.
But those safe harbors are incredibly narrow, right? Like, a foreign broker can't just buy a billboard in Times Square.
Oh, not even close. The first safe harbor is unsolicited transactions. If a U.S. retail investor is traveling or reading international news, and they call a broker in London completely out of the blue, unprompted, to buy a European stock, well, the London broker can execute that trade without registering in the U.S.
But realistically, you cannot build a sustainable, profitable business by just sitting by the phone hoping U.S. clients accidentally call you. You want to solicit. You want to send research reports and pitch deals. How does a foreign firm legally solicit in the U.S. without triggering full SEC registration?
They can only do it if they target a very specific elite tier of clients, and they must use a chaperoning U.S. broker-dealer. Specifically, they can only solicit major U.S. institutional investors.
Listener, here is the exam trap. Pay attention to the word major. In standard SEC rules, an institutional investor usually has $50 million in assets. But what is the threshold for a major U.S. institutional investor under this foreign exemption? Let's think about why the SEC would raise the bar for foreign exposure.
The threshold is $100 million in total assets. The SEC's logic is that a firm with $100 million has a massive, sophisticated internal compliance department. They have the resources to vet a foreign broker and understand the international risks. If a foreign broker directly calls up your average retail client, or even a smaller $20 million institution, they've violated federal law.
And what exactly is the role of this chaperoning U.S. broker-dealer? Are they just signing a piece of paper?
No, the chaperone takes on massive operational responsibility. The U.S. broker-dealer sits in the middle of the transaction. The foreign firm might give the advice or pitch the stock, but the U.S. chaperone actually handles the trade execution, maintains the custody of the funds, and keeps all the regulatory books and records.
Wow.
Yeah, the SEC essentially uses the U.S. firm as a regulatory hostage. If something goes wrong with the foreign trade, the SEC holds the U.S. chaperone accountable.
That makes sense. The SEC needs someone on U.S. soil they can subpoena if things go south. Okay, I want to shift gears to a concept that causes massive confusion. Here's where it gets really interesting. We've been talking about Broker Bob. We know he's registered as a broker dealer. But how do we keep Bob from accidentally having to register as an investment advisor?
This is one of the most critical boundaries in the financial industry. It is the dividing line between the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which governs broker dealers, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, which governs investment advisors.
And these are two fundamentally different regulatory universes.
Entirely different. An investment advisor who registers on Form ADV is legally a fiduciary. They're bound by the highest duty of loyalty to the client, and they typically charge asset-based fees for their advice. A broker dealer registered on Form BD is in the business of executing transactions. They charge commissions or markups, and when dealing with retail clients, they operate under Regulation Best Interest, or Reg BI.
But here is where it gets muddy. When Broker Bob calls me on a Tuesday and says, hey, I was looking at your portfolio and you should really buy 100 shares of Microsoft. I think it's a great fit for you. He is literally giving me investment advice. Why doesn't the SEC force him to register as an investment advisor right then and there?
Because of a very specific carve-out in the 1940 Act, known as the broker-dealer exclusion, the SEC recognized that giving a little bit of advice is naturally woven into the process of selling a stock. So a BD is excluded from IA registration if their advice meets two strict prongs. First, the advice must be solely incidental to their brokerage business. Second, they must receive no special compensation for that advice.
Solely incidental and no special compensation. Let's break those down. Solely incidental means Bob isn't advertising himself as a holistic financial planner. He's just saying, hey, this Microsoft stock looks good for this trade. It's tied to the transaction.
Correct. It is advice given in connection with the primary business of executing the brokerage order.
But what about the second prong? What exactly constitutes special compensation? If Bob charges me a $50 commission for the Microsoft trade, is that special compensation for his advice?
No. A commission is standard brokerage compensation for executing the trade. The SEC does not view that as paying for the advice itself. But what if Bob says, I'll execute your trades, but I'm also going to charge you a flat $1,000 fee to build a comprehensive financial plan, or I'm going to charge you an annual wrap fee of 1% of your assets.
The minute he charges a fee explicitly for planning or a wrap fee, the incentive structure changes. He is receiving special compensation.
Exactly. And the moment he receives special compensation, he completely loses the exclusion. Both prongs must be met. If he charges a planning fee, he crosses the boundary. He must now register as an investment advisor, which means he's duly registered and wears two completely different regulatory hats.
And that triggers a whole new wave of compliance requirements.
Okay,
we've built the firm, we've navigated FINRA's gatekeeping, we've registered our branches, we've avoided accidental IA status. Now, let's talk about the dark side. What happens when the system fails? What happens when Reckless Ricky breaks the law?
When things go wrong, the SEC and FINRA have severe administrative sanctioning authority. The goal is to protect the public from bad actors. Regulators can censure a firm, place strict limitations on its activities, suspend a registration for up to 12 months, or revoke the registration entirely.
Let's put Ricky in a scenario. Let's say Reckless Ricky committed financial fraud. He was inflating markups and lying to clients. He gets caught. He goes to court and he is convicted of a felony. The SEC is obviously coming for him.
If Ricky has a qualifying conviction, which includes any felony or a misdemeanor specifically involving securities, financial misconduct, perjury, or dishonesty, he becomes subject to statutory disqualification. The SEC and FINRA can bar him from the industry entirely.
But listener, here is a massive exam trap regarding the timing of those convictions. The rule states there is a 10-year look-back period for statutory disqualification based on a conviction, and this is a hard mathematical cliff.
It is absolute. The law operates on the principle of a statute of limitations for collateral consequences. If Ricky was convicted of wire fraud exactly 9 years and 11 months ago, the SEC can point to that conviction and say, you are statutorily disqualified. You are barred.
But what if he applies for registration and his conviction was 10 years and 1 day ago? Does FINRA still look at it? Let's think about how strict these rules usually are. It feels like they would still care, right?
They might care from a general risk perspective, but legally, it falls off the cliff. A conviction that is more than 10 years old no longer serves as a statutory basis for automatic disqualification under that specific provision. The 10-year mark is a hard line designed to balance public protection with the concept that a person can eventually be rehabilitated.
That is wild, but it makes the rule very easy to test. So Ricky gets barred. He is thrown out of the industry. But what about his boss? What about founder Fiona, who runs the firm? Is she completely off the hook because Ricky went rogue and hit his tracks?
No, and this is where principal liability comes in. Failure to supervise is a standalone, highly actionable basis for SEC and FINRA sanctions. The regulators don't just punish the rogue broker. They punish the environment that allowed the rogue broker to operate.
So Fiona can't just stand before FINRA and say, I had no idea Ricky was lying to clients. I didn't know.
In fact, saying I didn't know is practically an admission of guilt for a principal.
Mm.
The regulatory expectation is that Fiona must maintain a reasonable supervisory system designed to detect and prevent Ricky's fraud. If she didn't know, it means her system was broken. The failure is in not having a system that would have caught him. She can be fined, suspended, or barred for failure to supervise.
It forces firms to self-police. Okay, so let's say the dust settles. Ricky gets fired. Fiona pays a massive fine for failure to supervise, but the firm survives. The SEC allows them to keep their registration. Fiona's trying to rebuild client trust. Can she put a massive banner on her website that says, fully approved and endorsed by the SEC?
Absolutely not, under no circumstances. The misrepresentation of registration prohibition is incredibly strict. You cannot represent, imply, or suggest that registration with the SEC or FINRA means the government has approved your firm, endorsed your business practices, or passed judgment on your financial standing.
Because it's just a filing. The SEC isn't saying Fiona's an honest person and her firm is great. They are just saying Fiona filled out the paperwork correctly and we haven't revoked it yet.
Exactly. The SEC does not endorse anyone. The same applies to FINRA. You cannot run an ad saying FINRA approved our business model. You can only neutrally state, we are a member of FINRA. Any implication of a government quality stamp is considered a fraudulent and deceptive practice.
Because it creates an illusion of safety for the retail investor. They think, oh, the government endorsed this, it must be risk-free. Okay, let's say Fiona is just exhausted. Ricky ruined her nerves, the SEC fined her, the compliance costs are skyrocketing. She decides she is done. She wants to leave the securities industry entirely and shut the firm down. How does a firm legally die?
She files Form BDW, the Uniform Request for Broker-Dealer Withdrawal.
And how long does that take to process? Does she just hit submit and turn off the lights?
For SEC purposes, Form BDW becomes effective 60 days after it is filed, assuming the SEC doesn't step in to delay it because of pending customer complaints or ongoing investigations.
Okay, listener, let's explore a hypothetical. Direct question for you. Fiona files Form BDW, 60 days pass. Her withdrawal is fully effective with the SEC and FINRA. She retires to a beach. 6 months later, FINRA discovers that 2 years ago, reckless Ricky embezzled funds and Fiona actively helped him cover it up before she retired. Can FINRA still come after her even though she's no longer a member? Let's think about the mechanics of jurisdiction.
Yes, they absolutely can.
I call this FINRA's two-year ghost.
It is a vital regulatory mechanism. Under FINRA Bylaws Article 4, FINRA retains jurisdiction over a member firm for 2 years after the firm's registration is terminated. The exact same rule applies to associated persons like Ricky or Fiona who leave the industry.
Why 2 years? Why not just let them leave?
Because if jurisdiction ended the moment you quit, bad actors would use resignation as a shield. Imagine FINRA auditors walking into a branch office and the broker instantly realizes he's caught. If he could just say, I quit, and FINRA instantly lost the power to investigate or bar him, the system would collapse. Retaining jurisdiction for 24 months gives regulators time to uncover buried bodies, finish investigations, and permanently bar individuals so they can't just reapply a few years later.
You cannot outrun the regulatory bouncer. Okay, before we wrap up this deep dive, we have to talk about the absolute worst-case scenario for a customer. Let's look at dealer Dan. Dan is taking on all this inventory risk. Let's say the market crashes, Dan makes terrible bets, his firm completely collapses, goes bankrupt, and when the dust settles, client assets are physically missing. They're gone. Are the clients just out of luck?
No, they're protected by SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. With very few exceptions, all registered broker-dealers are automatically members of SIPC upon SEC registration.
Let's clarify what SIPC is. Is it a government agency like the FDIC for banks?
It is not a government agency, though it was created by an act of Congress in 1970. SIPC is a nonprofit membership corporation funded by its member broker-dealers. Its sole purpose is to protect customers if a brokerage firm fails financially.
But listener, here's the ultimate exam trap. What exactly does SIPC protect you from? Does it protect you from bad advice? If Broker Bob tells me to put my life savings into a biotech penny stock and it drops 99% the next day, does SIPC bail me out?
Absolutely not. SIPC does not cover market risk or investment losses. If you buy a terrible stock, that is on you. SIPC only steps in for the failure of the broker-dealer itself. It protects you if the firm goes bankrupt and your cash or securities are literally missing from the vault because of theft, fraud, or catastrophic operational failure.
Okay, so it replaces missing assets, but there are limits, right? It's not a blank check.
Correct. And the coverage limits are highly testable. SIPC covers up to $500,000 total per separate customer. But within that $500,000 total, there's a strict $250,000 sublimit for cash claims.
Let's do some math because this can get confusing on the test. Let's say I have a brokerage account with dealer Dan. I am a very conservative investor, so I have $400,000 in pure cash sitting in the account waiting to be invested, and I have $400,000 in blue chip stock. So my total account value is $800,000. Dan's firm goes bankrupt, fraud is uncovered, and everything is gone. Walk me through the SIPC payout mechanics.
Let's break it down into two buckets. First, we look at your cash. You have $400,000 in missing cash. However, SIPC imposes a strict $250,000 maximum sublimit on cash recovery. Why? Because brokerage accounts are not bank accounts. They are meant for investing, not for hoarding massive cash deposits. So for the cash portion, SIPC cuts you a check for $250,000. The remaining $150,000 in cash is unprotected by SIPC. You become a general creditor of the bankrupt firm for that amount.
Okay, so I got $250K for my cash. Now, what about my $400,000 in stock?
Now we look at the overall limit. The absolute maximum SIPC will pay any separate customer is $500,000 total. You have already used $250,000 of that limit on your cash claim. That leaves you with $250,000 of remaining coverage capacity. So even though you lost $400,000 in stock, SIPC can only give you the remaining $250,000.
Wow. So I get $250K for the cash, $250K for the stock. I max out at $500,000 total. My account was worth $800,000, which means I'm walking away with a $300,000 loss just because my broker failed.
Exactly. SIPC is a safety net, but it is not an unlimited guarantee. It's designed to protect average retail investors, but high net worth clients need to be aware of those limits.
All right. We have covered the entire life cycle of a broker dealer. From statutory definitions to the CRD to fine aura gatekeeping, foreign exemptions, IA status, and finally bankruptcy. It is time to distill everything down to the absolute most testable nuggets. We are doing a rapid fire recap. Ready?
Ready?
Let's start with capacity, broker versus dealer.
A broker acts as an agent and earns a commission. A dealer acts as the principal, taking on inventory risk, and earns a markup or markdown. They cannot act as both on the same trade.
Form BD organizational records retention.
Foundational documents like Form BD and partnership agreements must be kept for the life of the enterprise. Forever.
Founder Fiona files a CMA.
For a 25% single entity ownership change, she must file 30 days before closing, but can close without final approval. For a material business change, she can file any time, but must wait for explicit approval before acting.
Form BR OSJ triggers.
Holding customer funds, market making, or approving new accounts automatically upgrades a standard branch to an office of supervisory jurisdiction, requiring a principal on-site.
Retaining jurisdiction.
Fannie Mae's ghost follows you for 2 years after you file Form BDW or leave the industry. You cannot quit to escape an investigation.
Finally, SIPC limits.
$500,000 total per separate customer, which includes a strict $250,000 cash sublimit. And remember, it covers firm failure and missing assets, never market loss.
Incredible. So much complexity, but when you understand the mechanics of risk, it all fits together. As we close out, what is our final thought for the listener?
Think about the sheer amount of trust placed in the word registered. The SEC specifically forbids you from saying they endorse you because the entire financial system relies on an illusion of safety. Registration doesn't mean you're a genius, and it doesn't mean your firm won't fail. It just means you have handed the government a map of your operations, a list of your personnel, and a guide of where to look when things go horribly wrong. So as you study for the Series 24, remember you aren't just memorizing paperwork timelines. You are learning the anatomy of accountability. You are learning how the U.S. government builds a fence around systemic risk.
The anatomy of accountability. When you sit down for that exam, remember Broker Bob's commissions, remember Dealer Dan's inventory risk, and remember that as a Series 24 principal, you are the one responsible for keeping Reckless Ricky in check. If you understand the why, you can answer the what. You are armed, you are ready, and you are going to crush this test. Thanks for listening, everyone.